Welcome to Outspoken, where we dive deep into the topics and intersection of technology, money, business, and passion. I'm your host, Shayna Cosgrove.
When I talk about discovery sprints, I think what we're saying is that a lot of what we do is basically demonstrate the delta between how we think a service is architected and then in practice how it feels to an end user and how difficult it can be to use. While technology is usually part of that solution, it usually is only part of the solution.
I think there was like a little voice in my head that got louder like throughout art school, which was just like, I'm spending a lot of money to be here. Like, where do I land after this? What is the job that I'm working to?
We're happy being a 20-person team for now and being picky about the projects we take on. And I think a lot of partners we work with know that they're working with an organization that has like empathy at its core, and we are very people-centric. We have just been very selective about the kinds of projects we're taking on.
This podcast is sponsored by Nyla Technology Solutions, an SBA-certified 8A, HubZone, woman-owned small business specializing in full-stack software engineering and data science services to the U.S. government. Our innovative solutions are built to match the speed of mission. For more information, partnering opportunities, and new job openings, please visit our website, www.nyla.io. Thank you both so much for being here this afternoon on a fall day. I am speaking with
Lauren Lockwood
and Emily Wrightmore.
You both are in totally different locations, right? Where are both of you?
Just outside of Philadelphia.
And I am in Asheville, North Carolina.
So does this mean your company is completely remote and distributed?
Yes, and we were from the start, so we were well prepared for the pandemic.
And how did you two even meet if you've largely always been in different locations?
Yeah, we actually met on a project, which I feel like is so often how it happens in the civic tech space. But we were working together and both kind of doing our own independent things and thought, let's do our independent things together.
What kind of project were you working on? What were your roles?
Yeah, we were working with the state of Connecticut, and it was on a sort of a broader digital transformation journey. And so we were working closely on a part of a discovery team.
Not everyone knows what these terms are. So I think if you would just take some time to kind of lay out what digital transformation is, digital services. I'm 10 years older than both of you. And I feel like these terms are kind of new-ish, probably not new to you, but they weren't what you studied in college, right?
I still don't really know what digital transformation means. And like, it's one of those terms that when you're talking to somebody, you're pretty aware that it might mean something different to them. And you might carry on for quite some time before realizing that like you're having different conversations. I think digital transformation too, when we use it in the context of that project, is like working with an organization to get them in a place where they're able to use technology effectively, which is a tall order, right? Like when I joined at the VA, I remember they didn't have any cloud services approved. So that was just a big cultural shift and also a big like logistical shift of like getting to a point where we could buy cloud services and use cloud services.
You really often see in government contexts or in nonprofits or other organizations, technology is not often designed around the needs of the people who ultimately use it, especially in these sectors. And so when people talk about digital or digital transformation, wrapped up in that is centering the user, centering the people who are using the service, whether that's constituents in a government context or internal staff.
So I always think about the example of going and getting your driver's license and just even improving the experience of now to renew, you don't have to go in person. Or when I do some of my company items and updating my company information, it's all online and digital. And I think of one terrible example was the unemployment, how everyone was out of work during COVID and trying to get their benefits and the website kept crashing. So this essential service of making sure you could register, be validated and get your money during this very heightened time. And yet the website couldn't even stay up.
It's crazy when you think about it too, because that was a terrible experience for the people trying to use it, like either the DMV or otherwise, like, but it's also really bad for the people on the other side processing those applications. The site going down externally, like, what did that actually look like for an employee? Did that mean that they were either wasting time or not able to do their job, or were they getting totally bombarded with half done applications? There's two sides to what a bad experience that is.
So how much of your work is even level setting and bringing people to an understanding of the terminology and the art of the possible? Do you feel like you're walking the tail end of the technology curve, like into baby steps forward? Once I interviewed a man who still used a flip phone and kept it in his eyeglass case. Is that like your core government customer that you're working with?
Sometimes it's that, and sometimes it's this other version of reality where, like, if we work in government, we also go home and use all the cool tools for our personal lives, and understanding like what it takes to get from where they are to that current place, it feels like it should just be a flip of a switch. Like, I'm using Outlook 2006. It should be easy to just upgrade to the most recent version. But then when you zoom out and you're like, well, this is an organization with 500,000 people, upgrading all those machines is actually a pretty big undertaking. And so understanding like, what does it look like to move forward, even if you're still moving forward in the past? Once I had a meeting where we pulled up Google Maps, like we built a tool that like linked off to like a map with the data on it. And they thought that we made Google Maps. It was very awkward for a while. It was just kind of like, how do we like not make them feel really, really bad about this, but also like not take credit for something that they'll probably figure out?
Yeah, I think so much of what we do too is bridging that sort of like empathy gap between the people who often are in a position to buy technology or implement technology and the people who ultimately use the service. And I think during the pandemic, a lot more people had to apply for unemployment insurance than have in the past. And yes, of course, it was a bad experience when it crashed, but also it's just a bad experience. And even without it crashing. And so I think the helpful thing is that when we have more people using these services, it sort of elevates how broken they are. And so it allows us to sort of shine a light on how bad these services are and how much they differ from how we might think that they might be designed or used. When I talk about discovery sprints, I think what we're saying is that a lot of what we do is basically demonstrate the delta between how we think a service is architected and then in practice, how it feels to an end user and how difficult it can be to use. While technology is usually part of that solution, it usually is only part of the solution.
What's the other part?
A lot of times we think of it as sort of an iceberg, and the technology might seem like the tip of it. And then beneath it, you have all the people and the processes and policies that govern those services. And without thinking about those things, you might be plopping technology on top of a broken system or top of a broken process, and that technology will not fix those things. And so I think thinking about them holistically and seeing them holistically is really helpful for making sure that when you do implement technology, it's successful.
Can you describe your company for us?
Our company is BloomWorks. There's something that feels very regenerative around where we are right now, I think, in the civic tech space. And so that's really where the name comes from. And our organization is really about partnering with governments and nonprofit organizations to help them deliver services more effectively, in particular in service of more vulnerable populations.
And what are the core services? Like, what are the typical projects, or how do you come in, and what's a typical engagement look like?
I would say our core services right now are content, like plain language content. We actually spend a lot of time rewriting stuff that doesn't make sense to people. And on the flip side of that, we do a lot of design and research. A lot of it's comparing, what are you saying about this service in terms of like, okay, you got a notice for your unemployment benefits that you need to do X, Y, and Z. Do you know what those things mean and where to put them and send them? And then the other side of it is like talking to people using those services and seeing what questions they have, what they're bringing to that situation, and what context they're working in. So if we're asking them to do something, do they have the means to do it? And is it clear enough that they know how to act on it? And I would say the third service that is easiest to package is engineering, just building prototypes and solutions and lightweight tools that hopefully solve the problem that we see. For the most part, we usually start with the design, the research, and the content of a thing, because it's just like low-hanging fruit to me compared to the other pieces, and it's a lot less scary.
I have a lot of engineers who listen to this podcast. So let's get straight to your tech stack. So when you were implementing your prototype or MVPs, which phrase do you use?
We usually say prototype because it's more agnostic of the tool. So we could do a paper prototype where, you know, we show someone how something works. I mean, my favorite like research method is just like print something out and be like, where would you click? Show me with your finger. And then that's like, I don't have to take that to an engineer and have them rebuild it if we got it wrong. And then, yeah, tech stack, we use a lot of React, honestly. That would be our preference, but not going to lie, we have some projects in .NET. We've managed to avoid COBOL so far, so that's been nice.
Do you have a favorite wireframing tool or like user interface mockup tool?
We use Figma for most everything.
So there's a whole bunch of tools for this, right? How did you pick Figma?
I honestly defer to the team. And then at a certain point, like if everyone's using different stuff, it's like, okay, we gotta rein this in. I think Figma is the easiest to share stuff and get feedback on it. And a lot of these tools have like kind of modernized into having a link you can share with things. But I definitely don't miss the days of like downloading my sketch files into PDF and sending them over and getting an email with all their thoughts on it, trying to figure out what they're referencing.
How many users do you talk to before you feel you've hit the right amount of users to interview?
My rule of thumb is 5. But I also think if you're still getting surprised by what you're hearing, you probably need to keep going. But usually that happens after a few people. And maybe you just want to change your questions so that you're a level deeper into what you're trying to understand for the next round.
And sometimes it depends on the size of the problem too. I think if it's like a product question and we're asking somebody to interact with the form, it might be 5 per kind of user group. But like there are some times when people come to us with a question where it's like, we know that it's hard to apply for subsidized childcare in our state. Like the process is broken and we don't know how. And so it might be 5 people and we might learn that, you know, there are 5 different user groups that access it very differently. And in those situations we're kind of spidering out from there. We usually go in pretty open-mindedly, but totally to Emily's point, like it's usually fewer than you think.
Around here, a very common popular thing that has been taught for innovation and transformation is this concept called I-Corps, which is a Silicon Valley idea. And it's typically taking a product that you're developing and trying to find a market fit. And they say you need to interview 100 people. Now, do you have to heavily document all your user tests? Are that you recording all of them?
We try and record them for our own purposes, and then we'll delete them at the end of the project just because a lot of times we don't want that information getting out there. Like we want to respect their privacy, and we'll tell them that we're recording and the purposes behind it. But the other thing we do is identify who those 5 people are. We had a project recently where they wanted to do their own research. So we set them up with a script and they went to town on it, and we got it back and it was like, oh, wow, you only talked to white people. Like, this is okay. If you're going to pick 5 people, like, let's make sure we're representative of who we want to reach and also not causing any gaps from the start.
With confirmation bias, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, Lauren, you talked about user groups. Can you tell us a little bit more about what user groups typically look like for your projects and how many user groups there are per, say, service you're focused on?
You know, I really wish we had more standardized projects, but all of our projects are so different.
You don't have like old lady grandma, young mom, frazzled.
I wish we could just like copy paste our personas to every project.
I know, it'd make things cheaper
it'd
for
so
you.
Much easier. But turns out they're very different if you're talking about youth aging out of foster care versus like supporting a website redesign for, you know, a city in the Midwest. I think there are a lot of common things that we're asking, especially if we're talking about government services. So, you know, where are they accessing this? Where do they go for trusted information? What kind of devices do they have? So we try to, there are a lot of different factors that play into how we decide how many personas we need to be working with or user groups we need to be focused on. It just really depends on the problem.
Do you ever have the dream scenario where the client actually has like reams of actual data to help you clearly identify the user groups? They're like, oh, well, we've run through the services we provided over the last year, and clearly we've been able to identify these socioeconomic groups and location information. Do you ever have that scenario?
I definitely dream about that scenario. Once we worked on a, before Bloom, this was just when I was at USCS, but we worked on a form that the VA swore worked great. And I was supposed to set up a way that what I was working on would like route to it so they could do this online application. And I couldn't get it to work. And they were like, oh no, it works. People are just doing it wrong. And I found out that like it only worked in Internet Explorer 6 or something. So like, as long as they don't like swear that a certain group of users is just wrong, like then I feel like I'm good. I'm lucky.
Lauren, tell me about your favorite project that Bloom has undertaken so far.
The ones that are most fun to work on are ones where the partner that we're working with genuinely wants to learn something about the people who interact with their service and really want to make it better, not because they want a press release about it, but because they are genuinely looking to learn something and be surprised by what they hear. And so we did some work for an organization called Think of Us, and they support youth who are aging out of the foster care system. And I think that those were just really fun clients to work with, because Sixto Cancel, the head of that organization, you know, is so eloquent on the issues in that space and with lived experience in the space. And so it just, he comes at it from such a genuine motivation to improve outcomes for this group. And so that was a lot. That was just a really impactful and valuable place for us to spend our time.
What was the main digital service that you worked on for them? What was the primary use case?
This was a great example of one where the, you know, we came in thinking the solution might be an app, and we left with a very different understanding, and that the problem was a lot more complex than an app was going to be able to solve, and that we might better improve outcomes by actually starting at a different place in the process and focusing really more on healing the trauma that these youth face rather than providing them networking through an app. And so that work has gone in sort of a different direction. You know, we don't have a product, a technology product that we sell. We go into each product or each project rather, not really knowing what the outcome will be necessarily.
Is that stressful? I mean, I work with engineers, right? So we like a very clear answer. There might be like three different ways you can solve it. How do you feel comfortable like embracing like, I don't know, I don't even know how to scope this?
It is hard for scoping. And it's really, I have to say too, it's really hard for people who have not done this type of work before, both in government or, you know, people on our team. You know, it's hard for us to engage designers who haven't worked on with this level of ambiguity before, because it is hard, and it's hard to scope and hard to make sure, how do we know that we're on track? But we've, I think, found a format that really has worked for us, where we really tightly scope or time bound a discovery process and know that we will come out with some set number of key challenge areas or opportunities to improve outcomes, and then a plan to basically prototype solutions in those areas. And those solutions might be rewriting content to make a piece of information more clear, or it might be piloting sending text messages to a certain group to better communicate. So that's typically how we frame some of the work to make sure that we're keeping it tightly scoped and on track while still not having certainty about what exact thing we might be prototyping.
Emily, what's been your favorite project?
I love our work in child welfare. Like, I think when we're looking at a problem across the country that's broken into pieces and they're all trying to distribute federal funds in a different way with different requirements. And a good example is licensing for foster parents. Some states see a lot of vaccination requirements and a lot of testing requirements for anyone who's going to live in the home that a foster child would be in. And other states have figured out ways to reduce the restrictions and the little paper cuts along the process that parents are seeing and safely move forward. So it's been really cool to look across these different states, talk to all of them, start to see where a state has found a way to interpret federal guidance in a way that is not so restrictive. And I think that's probably the intent of the guidance anyway, is to create the best scenario for everyone. And other states are seeing this as like an impossible barrier that they can't get through, and actually to say like, oh, well, look how they did this. Like, let's write this down and share it so that other states can see that as well.
Well, it must be so nice that you can sit around at Thanksgiving and project your work, you know, bring up your laptop and your browser and like show grandma, here's the exact change I made. It must be so validating to have everyone be able to see it. And so many people are touched.
We're doing it with the intent of having it widely accessible. So it's hopefully also accessible to grandma. She can read it and understand it in a way that like she understands more at the end. Like I don't have to translate it.
In so many situations too, that's part of how, you know, we need to package it at the end as well. I mean, we did a lot of work in the organ donation space and reforming a pretty broken process right now in the US in terms of getting organs to those who need them. And when your audience is Congress, you have to summarize that report in a way that is concise and appealing to read. People who are busy are not going to spend their time reading 120 pages of what we learned talking to a lot of organizations and dissecting the technology that they use to figure out which organs go to which recipients. And so that's a big piece of what we do, is making sure that if we're asked to diagnose a pretty gnarly problem, is making sure that we get in the weeds enough and then also pull out enough to convey that information in a compelling and very clear way.
How long has the company been in existence?
So we were incorporated in 2018.
And how long before you had your first customer?
We actually started with a customer. And so like we were...
That's the best way to start. Exactly. Anyone listening, when you have the contract in hand, that's when you quit. Yeah. So you started right away.
Yeah, we were pretty organic in our growth. Emily and I were each independently consulting and had left government and were, you know, working with different organizations and working on the same project. And then that work got bigger and demanded more than we could provide individually. And so we added a developer and more designers and then grew that way. And so I think we didn't onboard our first full-time employee until August of 2019. And so most of our life has been in the pandemic, but it's been a very organic growth from day one.
You're the CEO of the company,
mm-hmm.
and you've had this really rapid growth, and you've had to figure out like the HR, the bigger payroll system, funding or anything like that. What's your split of working on a project for a client versus working on the company?
Those responsibilities grew quickly. And one hard part about having a remote team is that registering in different states and taxes in different states, and there are different requirements, HR requirements in each state, those issues ballooned, I think, a lot faster because we were remote. And so it quickly became untenable for me to be spending the majority of my time on projects. And so that's been a little bit hard, to be spending more and more of my time on the business itself. But it's enjoyable now that we have staffed up enough to support those functions that we can now return back to spending more time in the work. So I think now I'd say I'm probably 80% focused on the business, 20% on projects, but a lot of that time, it's still about the work, but it's more like business development.
Now you have an MBA from Harvard. Do you feel that well prepared you to start your own business? Were you like, golly gee, I came straight out of Harvard. This is super easy for me.
Absolutely not. I worked in government after leaving the MBA program. And so I quickly brought down the HBS, you know, earnings average straight out of the bat. But I actually thought I might spend longer in government. And starting Bloom was not a decision I architected, but really, again, started kind of just organically one step after the other. But now I will say a lot of the lessons that I learned as case studies at HBS are very real life now. And I feel like I understand them much better and should go back and reread them now that I'm feeling them firsthand.
What was your goal when you first went to HBS?
Before going to HBS, I was in investment banking at Morgan Stanley and saw a lot of issues with, I mean, all the investment banks and the way that they were ill-equipped to use technology to understand their products. It took me months to find an engineer at Morgan Stanley, and they were located in a basement of a building in New Jersey where I was like sitting in Times Square, you know. And so there's a big issue in a large organizations between the way that they think about technology and how powerful it is and where it's situated in the organization. And so I went to HBS because I wanted to further explore that. I spent some time doing that at Morgan Stanley and trying to, you know, I didn't have the words for it then, but explore digital transformation within an investment bank.
Did that make you the odd lady out?
Absolutely.
I mean, you were already a woman in investment banking.
Absolutely. I just wanted to better understand like who should we be lending to and things like that, you know, and I mean, there were a lot of these tools that they used to measure, but they weren't talking to the managing directors or analysts who were using these products to make extremely important and expensive decisions. And so that led me to go to HBS because I felt like there was an opportunity around using technology more effectively. And curiously enough, I actually spent a lot of time at HBS doing work around how little technology there was in the curriculum there, because they focus a lot on finance, they focus a lot on accounting, but not actually on working with CTOs. And so it was sort of a lesson I learned while there, and then became very interested in it. And then when I left HBS, the mayor in Boston, Mayor Marty Walsh, was looking for somebody to lead a digital service team. And so I raised my hand.
Where do you even get this idea that you want to be a digital transformation nerd instead of like focusing on being a quant nerd and exploring data science? Like, why aren't you writing Python scripts and pouring through tons of data, Lauren? And instead you're like in the touchy-feely talking to people and improving the words. I mean, if I was going to write like a Vogue expose, right? Like, you went straight from Vassar to Morgan Stanley Investment Banking, and then you go to HBS. And where does this desire to move into something totally different, right? You know, you go to the best school, you get hired into investment banking, right? And then maybe you get an MBA and you keep making like billions of dollars in finance. And most people never leave that.
So I went to work in investment banking, mostly to pay off my student loans that I accrued in undergrad. And because I had heard it was a meritocratic environment, and that's what I wanted. You work really hard, but you know, you get recognized if you're doing a good job. And I didn't know what I wanted to do well enough. I wanted to work. And so I...
Wait. Was it a meritocracy? Was it actually a meritocracy?
In some ways, yes. The work environment there was pretty awful, I would say. 100-hour work weeks are generally not enjoyable, but also the unpredictability of the hours. Like, you could be out with friends at, you know, 7 p.m. on a Friday and be told to get back to work, you know, or sorry, 7 p.m., forget it. No, you're in the office. But like 10 p.m. on a Friday, you're out with friends and you get told to come back to the office, your BlackBerry starts blinking. And that was really unpleasant. And so I looked ahead at the people who had been there for 10 years and realized, like, I don't want to be you. I don't want that for me.
Like, did you feel it in your gut? You were just like, oh no.
Yeah, I just, you know, I wanted to explore different kinds of things. And I was very cynical about MBA programs. I thought it was just an extraordinarily expensive vacation. And I actually had a conversation with somebody there who I trusted, a mentor. And she basically said, like, if you may want to start your own business someday, or if you want to be doing something innovative or different, then like the things that you need are, you know, a network, you need a curriculum in this. And she basically said, like, that's what an MBA is. So I took the GMAT like a couple weeks later and went to HBS. My husband was doing a PhD in Boston as well. So I joined him up there, which was nice to not have the commute from New York City to Boston anymore. But that's what brought me there.
I ask you all these questions because I got a computer science degree and then thought I was going to always get an MBA. So I had explored all of this and then I started freaking out about the loans and the cost. And to me, afterwards, I thought to take care of the loans, I was going to have to be a consultant at the Big Five. And the idea of flying all over sounded really unappealing to me. I guess I always felt like I was really into engineering and the type of engineering I was doing for DOD, they don't typically take like MBAs from Harvard or Stanford and then go back to like Lockheed Martin. That is not a common, that is not a common path of like, oh, I'm working on an airplane and I went to Stanford. You're typically back into the finance or sales section of it versus the engineering management.
In some ways, I feel like the opposite. Like, if I knew then what I know now, I would have gone straight into computer science. And I would have been learning Python instead of Excel. I didn't know then what I know now. And so here I am.
What made you say yes when the mayor of Boston said, come join my office?
There were several people there already in his administration who were, I think, demonstrating that they were open to new ideas and ways of working. And I had met Rachel Hout, who had been the chief digital officer for New York City, and saw the kinds of work she was doing there. And so I had seen a proof of concept prototype for digital transformation done well in government contexts. And so that I thought was very exciting. And the idea of taking a startup culture or aspects that are functional, like product teams and engineering from a startup to then put that in City Hall, I thought was just a really interesting idea. And so that's what made me see us.
When you joined, was there a commitment for how long you had to do it for?
No, but I think it was, you know, it takes a while to get up to speed. And so it's not worth doing if you're not planning to really get in there and make an impact. I think that's the benefit of working in-house in government, is that you get to go a long way. You're not just sort of trying to manage by influence. You get to just make a call, and we get to decide, like, we're going to redo the city's website. We're going to figure out a way to get the budget for it. And that's oversimplifying it in a lot of ways, because it's hard. It's hard to get the right kinds of people and the right kinds of positions allocated for your team, especially modern positions. Like, even a product manager was unheard of. And we had to have a long process to work with HR to understand what that role looks like, because they're very uncomfortable with the technical designation as a manager if you're not managing somebody. You know, and so there are just a lot of things like that seem small in the private sector, but are really big.
Did you have to do like some made up term instead?
I'm sure it was like Project Analyst 3, you know, and then we just like voiced over the rest of it.
That's so common. So what was your first initiative that you drove out?
The first major one was redoing Boston.gov. But I also personally inherited all of the city's social media when I joined. That coincided with like 5 blizzards in a row. And so a lot of it was just managing information, getting information to the public. And I think through that process, saw how broken things like our website were and how important it was to have functional technology to be able to just do something simple, like get messages to the public.
I wanted to know, both of you, when you were little, what did you think your life would be like when you were grown up?
I feel like when you're little, you think that there are like 4 professions. Like, you can be like a lawyer or a doctor or like a teacher. Probably in my mind, I thought I would be one of those things, but I never imagined myself having a family when I was little. It was only, I think, probably in college and after I was with my husband, now husband, that I started to think that I might not just work forever or only work. I think I expected to be sort of like a workaholic full time.
What was about being a little girl that you were like, I think a workaholic life sounds like it's for me?
When you're a kid, you like get in the flow doing things like building stuff. And I don't know, I just didn't think I was selfless enough or something to have kids. I just viewed parenthood as a thing that demands a lot of you. And I wasn't sure I was up for that.
Well, that's a pretty accurate reflection, though. Yeah. But somehow this like love glue gets in your brain and you're like, oh, I think I want to try it. Now, when you went off to college, what was your expectation going into college?
You know, I didn't know what I wanted to do going into college. So I specifically chose a liberal arts school. And so I decided I'd take the time and learn how to think critically rather than learn material necessarily. And so I did a lot of philosophy and math and economics there, not knowing what I wanted to do. And it was only really like toward the end that I picked a job. And even still, it has like a lot of like non sequiturs into what I'm doing now. So I don't know if that was the right choice.
Did you feel a push when you were growing up to go into STEM or study computer science at all? Was that floated down to you as a young child at all?
I think if I had been a few years younger, that would have been the case. And I'm really disappointed that it wasn't posed as more of an opportunity early on. Even in college, I think it was viewed as sort of like a, you know, a very niche thing that in hindsight, I really wish I had done.
Emily, tell me about what you were like as a little girl. What were your dreams and hopes?
I think I had a lot of adventure in mind. I wanted to be one of those window washers on the skyscrapers. Like, that just seems so fun. And so that was kind of where I stopped. I was like, that seems cool. I could go way up high.
I got to say, that's probably a first. I've talked to a lot of people in my life and I have never heard anyone. But so you're not afraid of heights?
No, not afraid of heights.
You are a young girl. And in high school, you're still thinking window washer?
No, high school, at some point I just decided like the creative art world was for me. So I went to an arts high school and took almost all arts, like arts magnet type of classes.
You weren't dissuaded from doing that?
No, you know, there wasn't a lot of pressure from my family to pursue bigger career work. Neither of my parents had gone to college. They had us pretty young. And then my mom did go to college when I was a kid.
What did she study?
She's a nurse. So yeah, it was kind of like, oh yeah, you should go be an artist. And so I was like, okay, this sounds fun. For college, I went to Parsons. And then somewhere in there realized that like, I was just making art and putting it in the closet. And I actually wanted to like participate in the world a little bit more. Not that artists aren't participating in the world. It was just a little bit lonely.
What kind of art? What's your medium?
I did a lot of sculpture. I did illustration was my major.
So when you graduated, what was your first job after graduation?
Have you ever heard of graphic facilitation? So I worked for this little firm that would go to meetings for big companies and illustrate the meeting on the wall. So they would draw live what was happening in the meeting and then come back. We would like digest it, simplify it, and send it back. It was really useful for companies that were going through like big mergers or acquisitions. So it was this like weird deep dive from illustration into like corporate culture.
What's so interesting is, especially in tech or especially in software, they don't lead with a visualization, right? They talk about what they want, but they don't lead with even often a piece of paper that draws out like a sketch of what the user interface could look like and start there. And so rarely it's like a very clear wall between the user interface and focusing on the outcomes and the expression of that. And I have found, because I've written so many product strategies, that no one reads a strategy. And at the end of the day, I had to create like the version of, you know, when you're building a construction site, they have a 3D model. So you really do, at the end of the day, the most valuable thing I had was, here's the end state that we want to build, right? Here is a visualization. You can clearly see the functions because nobody read the product strategy. Now, tell me a little bit about Parsons, because Parsons is the school. What was your experience like?
So for the first year, we were all in the same blob. And then the second year, everybody kind of specializes. It was cool. It was competitive. And like a lot of people worked crazy, crazy long hours and were up all night, all year. And I was somewhere in the middle.
Did you love it? Would you do it again?
No, it sounds terrible to do it again. Well, and like always, I think there was like a little voice in my head that got louder, like throughout art school, which was just like, I'm spending a lot of money to be here. Like, where do I land after this? Like, what is the job that I'm working to?
Did you get coaching at your school for what to do when you graduate?
For illustration, it was like, we had working illustrators who would teach us and tell us about how to like get work. But I wasn't envious of their lifestyle. Like, I wasn't like, that looks cushy, or that looks like they've made it. Like, it was kind of like, wow, you are really a successful and famous illustrator, and I'm amazed to be in your class, and you're clearly teaching for the money.
I always tell people your gut reaction is so important. And I worked at this one company that was amazing and lovely. And I saw older women who were successful at the company. And I just had this feeling of like, if I am here when I am their age, like I have not lived the life I've wanted to, right? Like, and it was a very lovely place. And it feels snotty to be like, I don't want to be like you, right?
Too. Yeah.
But I think that's a very entrepreneur thing as well, to feel that your perspective is different and unique and that you've got to put it out there in the world versus joining what's already out there. And I had a similar feeling for these companies that I worked for, where it's like, nope, I'm not inspired. I don't want to help build this collective because I don't believe in it.
For illustration in particular, they were all really solo. Like, it's not a team sport, you know, like, like you're just you and you develop your own brand and you take it as far as you can. So it, in some ways it felt like it was always going to be about me.
Lonely.
And I was like, I'm not that interesting. Like, I don't ever want to be that interesting. I just would like to like work on other interesting things, which is kind of why I like this government space, because we get to do cool stuff. It's not about me at all, which is great.
You like the team aspect of it too.
Yeah.
That real integration. I had a similar experience in computer science where they teach it a lot as if it is a solo effort, as if communication skills are not important at all. And even in software, even if you are the best in software, it is still a collaborative effort. Even with the best API and component, you still at the end of the day have to provide something that works in something else. So if something else isn't working, you might have to influence people to change theirs. And those skills of collaboration are so critical. Tell me something about your profession, this field of digital services that is so new that you think is a common misperception that you'd like to debunk?
There's a general perception that a lot of the really poor service delivery has to do with people being stodgy or sort of like incompetent or something like that. Like there's a whole trope of what it means to work for government. And there's a great, I think it was like an Atlantic article about the grumpy bureaucrat or something like that. And just the article goes in depth, kind of this journalist actually worked at, I think it was a social services agency for a year to watch them process claims and just developed a tremendous amount of empathy with the person who's sort of tasked with triaging these different claims and the tremendous tasks that they're burdened with. And I don't know, I think that until you work in government, it's really hard to understand how incredibly, not just like warm, but how understanding these folks are who are processing claims and having to do a tremendous amount of work each day to get people the services they need, but also are working within really imperfect systems and working with really horrible technology and are doing their very best and would love to see it improve. And I think the hard part is that you hear stories, especially during COVID, of like these $50 websites that are going to fix the world. And it's like, I think that's like the other side of it, is that there are all these like quick fix opportunities. And I think when you spend time working in government, you appreciate how complex the system is and how smart the people are who are working to like within these structures, but that it's complicated. There aren't easy fixes in a lot of cases. There are things we can do to, I think, better understand where the problems are stemming from and start addressing some of the root causes, but there's no slapdash thing you're going to put on top of a broken system to fix it all.
Can you tell us all about what is U.S. Digital Service?
United States Digital Service. It was Obama's tech team that he brought in. It has stayed through Trump and is now like probably bigger than ever during the Biden administration. It's a bunch of small digital service teams in different agencies that swoop in to work on priorities established from the White House and administration.
And who was the leader and creator of the first U.S. Digital Service organization?
The leader was Mikey Dickerson for the first iteration. It morphed out of the healthcare.gov tech team that came in and worked on healthcare.gov. So it was a group of people. Jennifer Palka was there. You know, there's a Fast Company article with all of them looking very fierce. And it also had a bunch of former 18F Presidential Innovation Fellows and a massing of people towards a common effort led by Mikey Dickerson.
How did you come to be part of that organization?
I had been waiting for an opportunity to go back into government technology. I'd done the Code for America Fellowship, which is local government. So I'd worked for the city of Austin. And then I'd gone back in. There wasn't really anything to do that I could find after that that was a good follow-up. So I went, I was at a tech company called Twilio. So I was just kind of waiting. And then I saw Marina Martin speak at like a recruiting event. And she was talking about, I'm starting a team at the VA. I have like 40 something headcount that I can hire for to build this team. But it's taken me 6 months and I have yet to figure out how to hire a single person through USA Jobs. And so she was kind of like, come join me once I figure it out. Like, let's do this. And it was just this moment where I was just like, I want to work for her. Like, I like what she's saying. I like how she's approaching her work. And she just had this like sort of tiny but mighty vibe going on. So I then applied to USDS and I had known some people there. So it wasn't a total cold thing, but I joined when they formed that VA team. So there were six of us who started at one time. And from there, we just tried to figure out what was most important to work on and got started kind of from what felt like zero, though, you know, Marina had been there kind of laying groundwork for a while.
What did you do after your tour?
I went back into sort of tech world for a little bit it was really a cool job, but I was pretty burnt out. So I worked at a tech company for a while and then I got bored pretty quick. I was like, this just doesn't feel as exciting. And then I was consulting for states, and that's when I met Lauren. So here we are. That brings us to now.
Now, Lauren, you had a unique background too.
It is actually really funny how different the approach was to like the digital service team in Boston. I hadn't really thought about this before, but the team there was intentionally meant to be permanent rather than a tour of duty model. We had a group that was, I think, a little bit like USDS in Boston for, I think that was founded in 2004 or 2006 under Mayor Menino, called New Urban Mechanics. And they're the ones who like invented the 311 app and stuff like that. It was interesting because the digital service team was like working with them, but was like intentionally like bringing in modern developers and designers into the IT infrastructure with the explicit intent of doing things like changing the way that the city develops like technology and things like that. And I think in a lot of ways, it was just kind of a welcome resource. The web team hadn't had a developer on it. And so I think when we had a developer, it was like, oh my God, finally. And everyone was, you know, just thankful to have that resource. And so it was like a little bit less cultural friction. I mean, there's still going to be that when you have, especially in a city, there's a lot of culture in City Hall around like a very specific type of background. A high percentage of folks who work at City Hall in Boston are Irish and have, you know, strong Boston accent. There's a very strong Boston culture there. And so when you have people who don't share that identity and are young and are coming from outside of Boston and things like that, you know, there's going to be some amount of friction, but it was meant to be permanent, like a sort of a permanent piece of the IT infrastructure. So in that sense, it was a little bit different than I think USDS, that model. The ultimate goal of trying to improve services remains, but just sort of like a different entry point there.
Tech is known for being very ageist. Is that been your experience? And what do you think your company needs to do as you become older leaders in tech? There's that cliff of 40 for tech. What do you need to do to stay relevant and still be that exciting consultant coming in, but you're fresh on the technology and the capabilities?
It's really interesting because I think that there is some amount of ageism, but I also just feel like there is a cultural difference between people who have worked in government and have been in government for their careers versus people who have been sort of in the private sector, and going back to that mindset of sort of oversimplifying the complex systems in government and not just IT systems, but policies and processes and silos. I think that the biggest cultural issue right now is just bridging that divide, making sure that people appreciate how difficult the problems are so that there's not a sense that like a $50 website, again, is going to fix things. That's where a lot of that tension comes from, is that people working in these systems see how complex the problems are. And then you, at the other hand, you see news articles about quick fixes. And it's just, that's, I think, where some of the rub is that there's just like a lack of understanding for how much you need those COBOL developers, for example, to work with you to improve unemployment insurance. You can't discard what's there and what has been because it was built with a lot of thought and intention. It's just that, you know, we need to upgrade those systems. So I think professionalizing a new way of working and using new models and new processes to achieve better outcomes is a thing that we're going to need to work really hard on and build trust around, because right now I think it doesn't come without some amount of experience. And so we're still kind of getting there.
You know, we have a lot of younger folks on our team. I just try and put them in front sometimes. Like, they need the practice, and I feel like they see things I don't.
Is that perpetuating that only young people can exist in tech and then you age out? From my outside perspective, and I'm still a young woman myself, but USDS, part of it was young hotshots, right? Not even a blend, right? There wasn't kind of this consultant-like blend of people coming in. It was, oh, here's a bunch of young people. And because they're young, they're innovative and they have better ideas, which to me, so yeah, I'm like clearly on a pedestal stomping my foot here, but I think that especially as we continue to have a lack of talent in tech, we continue to push out a lot of people in tech as well, because it is so pervasive, this default assumption that because you're young, you are more valuable or you know what to do from a better perspective. And I think that's what Lauren's been talking about, of Yeah, you don't necessarily know because you haven't dealt with this level of complexity. Like, you don't even have an enterprise class in your undergrad, right? And maybe you worked on some very small programming subsets, and now you're working with this system that's larger and has more users than you could ever imagine.
You know, I actually haven't thought about this that much. It's interesting. I think you're right. USGS was, I remember there being a big variance in age. There were people who were really young, and there were people who were pretty much coming out of retirement to do it. So there was a lot of different age. I mean, like, one of the people on our team was one of the first employees from Amazon. So like, there was this perception that we were dudes in t-shirts. I can't remember which, I think it was one of the talk show comedians. I think Jon Stewart called us that, like, dudes in t-shirts, and all of us were up in arms. We were like, we're not all dudes and we're not wearing t-shirts. But there was a lot more variance than it appeared from the outside. But I do understand the perception, and I think it is problematic.
Now, what about sexism in tech?
Oh, that's a whole other topic.
It's a lot. One of my favorite moments in a meeting was early on working with a state. Me, Emily, and this other woman show up for like our first, you know, meeting with their team to redesign some of their systems. And the people from this agency walk in. The commissioner is a woman, her deputy is a woman, and they sit down with us, and they're like, so relieved that we weren't just a team of dudes walking into the room. And it was just not a thing I, you know, think about very often, I guess, but it was a huge release to them, and, or just like they were surprised and they were excited to see that. And I, until then, hadn't really appreciated how much it matters to our partners to have, see that amount of diversity in the teams that are coming to work on their problems. So I love that.
Do you feel like you have to work extra hard to show your value as a seller of solving digital problems?
We do have to fight harder for engineering credibility than just design. Like, I think people just accept design and they just assume we're mostly a design and content agency. And in some ways that's not wrong, but like, it feels like we have to work extra hard for the engineering cred than the others.
Okay, your competitors are mostly male-led teams. Are there any digital service competitors that you know of that are other female-led companies?
There are a few, but they're pretty rare. And I feel like we also don't have the same growth mindset or the same focus on growth as a lot of other companies in this space. And so, you know, we're happy being a 20-person team for now and being picky about the projects we take on. And I think you see a lot of us in the company's brand. And so I feel like in some ways, I think a lot of partners we work with know that they're working with an organization that has like empathy at its core, and we are very people-centric. And so I feel like we benefit from those assumptions. But like Emily said, we are finding ourselves having to fight harder around the technology quals.
What advice do you have for your younger self? You could go back to yourself in your 20s. What would be your main piece of advice?
I kind of just want to tell myself I was doing a good job. Like, I think I spent so much of it wondering where I was going and like felt like my career path was not like direct enough. I don't know who said it, but I love the jungle gym versus a ladder. I feel like we default to this like specialist mindset. And like, I think being a generalist is pretty great. I like knowing a lot of things and I like pulling in a lot of past jobs and past skills. So I feel like I would just stop worrying about that. Like, it's fine.
Mine would be very similar. I think it was Sheryl Sandberg that did the jungle gym metaphor, but I really feel like rebranding college and the lead up and high school and even the experiences between high school and college, if you go to college or after college, as being an exploratory time in your career and a time to just have a lot of experiences. I think I learned a lot that I didn't expect to learn. And I felt like Emily, you're supposed to be on a ladder, and it's not, I don't think, a particularly useful way of framing it. Switching careers is not a failure, I don't think. I think it is like you learned a lot and it was good for that time, but not necessarily forever. I worked on Wall Street. I learned that like I really don't like wearing a suit every day, and it changes the way I interact with people when I'm wearing a suit. And so that is a value I have. There are a lot of things like that, micro lessons, I think, that you learn. And I think it's in some ways really limiting to brand yourself as not a design person like I did when I was younger. And I think I just closed off a lot of opportunities for myself because I felt like I needed to be on a path. And so think of this time as an exploratory time rather than a first step on a journey.
I'm a huge reader, so I'm interested in what book has made a large impact on you, either personally or professionally.
I actually, during the pandemic, started a book club with my sisters and my mom, and we sort of like meet virtually every month, which is good because it's a good encouragement to get through a book a month. Right now, I'm reading The Overstory, which I'm really liking, and I'm finding sort of useful for, in general, I sort of like reminders of how small each of us is individually and how big the world is. And so I feel like that's a great book for appreciating just how big and complex trees are, but the world around us, despite being trapped in our own individual bubbles.
Is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't ask, like any last chance to bring something up?
It's exciting right now to be part of an industry where I feel like it's getting, there's been a lot of groundwork being laid for several years, and now we're starting to see, I don't want to call it a tipping point, but you're starting to see a lot of it get a little bit more institutionalized, and not just in the sense that, you know, there are federal groups like USDS and 18F, but that it's really becoming much bigger than any federal group. It's like you're seeing a lot of this pan out in with a level of like cohesion that I hadn't seen before. And so I think it's really exciting to see the whole ecosystem being built up, not just some teams within various cities or agencies, but you're seeing vendors who are saying the same things as folks working in government and nonprofits. And I think that that just feels like a really healthy place to be and an exciting place to be to see a lot of these ideas take hold. So the fact that some of our work, like working, partnering with New America, for example, to improve unemployment insurance, that was a really fun project. But the fact that we can be partnering with a group like New America and a bunch of other smart people who are advising on that project to take lessons learned from different states, pull it into a playbook where the Department of Labor is using that. You know, all of these systems are sort of feeling like they're working together, and it's cool to be part of that, to feel like we're part of that and adding something, contributing something meaningful to that.
I've never thought I would be able to work on the types of projects that we're working on, and they're just really awesome. We get to work a lot on child welfare, looking at how different agencies are recruiting foster families and resource families and how they're keeping track of whether they have the right placements for different groups. And I think there's progress being made in tiny pockets. And so a lot of our work is around like finding those pockets and trying to talk about them so that other states can replicate. So like one thing Marina, who we're working on with on this, says a lot is states like to be second. You know, like in government, it's great to be second. And I think just embracing that and saying like, okay, well, who's been first and who did cool stuff and how do we bring that somewhere else?
In tech terms, I call that reference implementation. People need to see something that's working, right? So not only do we want to start with the end state in mind, but people are always like, yeah, you go. You try it. Let me know how it goes.
Finding those things that are working and have a little bit of like, whether it's outcome data that we have or it's like just logical, like, oh, they made it through this hurdle that everyone's facing. And let's figure out a way to share that with other states. There's just a lot of cool opportunities in these sort of spaces and pockets of things. So I'm just excited about it.
Well, congratulations to you both for all of your success. And thank you for taking the time with me this morning. And I'm going to go get out of my jammies now.
Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And it's been nice to talk to you. One day I'll ask you the reverse of all the questions because I'm just curious.
Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. Please be sure to share it with friends and family. If you'd like to follow us on social media, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn under the Outspoken Podcast. Thanks again, and chin up, heads up, eyes forward.